From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last month when Monroe County Executive Adam Bellow appointed a new permanent public health commissioner. Dr. Maria Elena Velez de Brown begins a six-year term, but she is not a newcomer to public health or this department. She has a long resume with experience that goes in a number of different directions, and she has strong views on American health and health care. She has said that we don't really have health care. We have sick care. We need to do much better at prevention. She comes into this position at an interesting time, to say the least, with declining public trust in public health. And with a number of federal appointments on the way, we could soon see a dramatically different approach to things like vaccines, food products, and more. It's a fight about prevention, and many public health leaders across the country are concerned that we could be about to let our guard down in a number of different ways. Being in clinic with patients, Dr. Velez de Brown said she would routinely see people who just didn't have what they needed to live healthy lives, to prevent illness or other problems. She knew she wanted to make a difference in public health, and she wanted underserved communities to get the care that they need and deserve. Dr. Velez de Brown is from Philly, roots in Puerto Rico. She says health disparities are powerful forces and need to be eradicated. We have a lot to talk about. It is a pleasure to welcome the Monroe County Public Health Commissioner, Dr. Maria Elena Velez de Brown. Welcome, Dr. Velez de Brown.
Thank you so much for having me.
Why don't you tell listeners a little bit more about your background in medicine, healthcare, et cetera. I know you're a physician trained in family medicine. Mm-hmm. Been here for just over a decade now?
Yes. So I am a family medicine trained physician, and I came up to Rochester in 2014 to do a preventive medicine and public health residency program at the University of Rochester. 2-year fellowship. Supposed to run back home, and my mom's mad that I'm still here a decade later.
It happened to me, too. I came here 20 years ago, and it's like, that'll be a 3 years.
Yep. Here I am. And as part of that training, you get to do a rotation with your local health department. I loved it. I love the variety. I love the way that there are so many really dedicated individuals doing such a wide diversity of programming and work in service of community members, in service of giving people the ability to make a healthy choice, because all of our health choices are not made in a vacuum. And so I was able to land the deputy commissioner position in 2016, and I've been with the department ever since.
Well, Pew Research says we've reached the lowest point in public trust in public health and medicine in decades. Now, that's a nationwide survey, of course. Mm-hmm. But do you sense a decline in public trust here?
I do. I think we this community is not unique in having been targeted with significant amounts of disinformation and misinformation, certainly even before the pandemic, but during the COVID-19 pandemic. There are some well-documented players that are intentionally feeding bad information to incite fear, to lead to policy changes that are in maybe the best interest of a few as opposed to the whole. And that's the focus of public health, is to do the most good for the largest number of people. So we have seen some of that. We saw some of that in terms of vaccine uptake rates, certainly during the pandemic, and even beyond now into this era as well. But I would push back a little bit on this kind of gloom and doomsday sentiment. There are still so many people who believe in science, who are asking for credible, reliable, evidence-based information, and are really taking that into account to make the healthiest choice possible for their families. So I do want to highlight that the landscape is changing and might become somewhat more difficult in the near future, but there are still a lot of good people doing a lot of good work and a lot of people that are quite receptive to credible information.
Well, so let me ask you about not only a couple of things that have been, I guess we would call them hot buttons in the news lately, but also I think it gets at how you view the difference between bad faith trolling or disinformation or misinformation versus true public confusion or mm-hmm. genuine curiosity about an issue. And I'm going to give you an example that for some reason comes to mind for me that is, it's a weird one, but I think it illustrates where people sometimes do get tripped up. So I know you've talked in various interviews recently about fluoride in water, and we'll talk about that in a second, fluoridated water. Part of that is because whether it's RFK Jr., who could be in charge of a lot of public health real soon, or his acolytes, there's a claim that, you know, we should be going away from fluoridated water. So I have a CPAP machine, and I have to use distilled water in as part of the basin. And one day when I was lazy, I'm like, well, I'll just use regular water. And within a couple of nights, you get like this collection of like kind of this filmy deposit at the bottom of the basin. And so my first instinct was like, wait a second, like that doesn't look healthy. The distilled water looks like it's got to be the healthier. I should just be drinking distilled water.
Not necessarily.
As opposed to just using it in CPAP, because I don't want that collection of whatever that stuff is. And then I started reading, of course, and it was like, now you've got this all wrong. You want the distilled water for the CPAP machine, but you do not want to be necessarily drinking that because that's a good way to have your teeth, you know, really deform over time. But for the moment, it looked to me like a logical thing, like, oh, the distilled water never leaves anything behind. It's the cleanest version of it. Why would we fluoridate? Why would we put anything in there? Right. And I had this genuine question. So I think there is a difference, and I know you've talked about this too. How do you distinguish between, like, well, this is a genuine question, this is a good faith question, versus this is disinformation, this is trolling, and this is maybe dangerous, or this should be sort of ignored if possible.
Right, right. And I think the onus is on us as healthcare providers, as public health officials, to focus on getting accurate information out. So I'm glad that someone had written, published some article that could inform you when you had a genuine question and you did the homework and the legwork to get an evidence-based answer. I think it is so important for us to use reliable champions and messengers that are already trusted, especially in specific communities that have every good reason to have mistrust in institutions. There's historical racism. There's documented historical instances of people of color, people living in poverty, being used in experiments without their consent or against their will. And so there are valid reasons
Absolutely.
To be skeptical.
Oh, yeah.
And so it is incumbent on us to build up that, for example, vaccine confidence and educate people about how does your body actually work? How do these vaccines actually prepare your body to fight an infection? The fact that, no, the flu vaccine is not going to give you the flu. And so someone who is trying to make an informed decision is going to come to their own conclusion. And most of those folks are not going to be as antagonistic as a troll, as you mentioned. And so our time is much better spent making sure that we put that reliable information out there for those that are genuinely seeking it, and take it and make extra efforts to put it in different languages and work with our ASL interpreter colleagues to get a vlog posted somewhere so that everyone has equitable access to correct information.
For people wondering, fluoridated water is A-okay with you?
Yes. Yes. Fluoridating water came from that practice has grown out of observational studies that indicated areas in, you know, the country that just naturally had higher levels of fluoride, you would see lower levels of oral decay, tooth decay. And so that has a huge impact on a person's ability to nourish themselves. Oral health is incredibly important. And so based on those observational studies, that is why we now fluoridate our water. And there have been so many studies that have debunked the concern that we're increasing cancer rates in young people or anything like that. So, yes, I am grateful that fluoridation is a way to help everyone have access to better health, especially in an era and a geography where dental health care providers are so limited, especially in the pediatric practices. Like, thank God for fluoridated water.
I want to respect your position and not seek to make this an hour that is political because you are the public health commissioner for everybody.
Yeah.
And this is not us. This is ostensibly not a political or partisan position.
It shouldn't be.
It should not be. So the reason I invoke certain names is because of certain policies or ideas that are now very much out there. And one of them has taken root about vaccines. And the supporters of someone like RFK are now in just about every online space you can find. And here's what they often say. They'll say, listen, if you want a vaccine, you'll still be able to get it. That's not going to change. So you should stop complaining if we remove vaccine requirements in schools, if we change the language we use to talk about the polio vaccine. If you like them, still get them. That's up to you. So why are you complaining? I see that everywhere. It's people saying, like, you're acting like RFK is going to take away all vaccines. He's not going to take them away. He's going to remove requirements in schools and places like that. And you can still get them. It's a free country. What do you think?
So, again, public health is the balance of doing the most good for the most people. And sometimes there can be this perceived conflict with individual rights. But if you take the school age vaccination example, there are medical conditions that preclude individuals from getting the benefit of the vaccines if they have specific immune conditions, whatever. There's a list, laundry list of folks who physically, for their health and well-being, cannot get a vaccine. So the rest of us get vaccinated to create what we call herd immunity. If you and I and everyone in this WXXI station building are vaccinated and someone walks in that can't get that vaccine, the fact that all of us are protected and are not going to be carrying and coughing and transmitting whatever virus means we're protecting our neighbor. And so there is a balance of everyone has the right to free education in this country, but one individual's choice shouldn't put someone else's child at risk of what are potentially lethal vaccine-preventable illnesses.
How concerned are you that we will see these kind of policy changes that could lead to those school K through 12-wide changes?
There is some concern around that. And certainly, you know, national organizations, the National Association of City and County Health Officials, even our New York State Association of County Health Officials, we are in conversations about how do we maintain the work that we are already doing? How do we continue to educate and encourage folks to do that? And certainly, we are happy to educate our legislative colleagues and explain the benefits of many of these policies to folks that may be coming into power that might have a different view. But we are committed to continuing to do that good work regardless of any of those legal changes, because a lot of the benefits we have seen, the decreased in rates of polio you mentioned, that is because we have such high vaccination rates. And the second we take those requirements away, we're going to start seeing resurgence. We actually already have seen resurgences of specific conditions. We've had more cases of whooping cough this year than since 2016.
In Monroe County?
In Monroe County. And so we're already seeing some of those consequences. And we can already predict it, and we already see it happening to a thankfully still limited scale. But we are going to continue to do this good work, to educate the folks in power, and to bring, as I said, the credible information to the regular person out in the world just trying to make the best decision for themselves and their family.
Megan Mack, see if I'm remembering this correctly. I think it was Senator Mitch McConnell who recently talked about polio. I think he is a polio survivor himself and was affected by it in his childhood. And he felt compelled to make public statements in favor of the polio vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
He's in his 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And his office has said the senator did not think that this was an issue that was going to be revisited. Is it bizarre to you that we are kind of debating? I don't think most people are debating polio vaccines still, but
yes,
a lot of powerful people are indicating that we should. Is it bizarre to you?
It's surprising and unfortunate. And again, we just need to continue to educate folks about the importance. That's one of the supposed problems with public health, is that when we are working towards prevention, how do you prove a negative? How do we prove to these naysayers that the fact that you don't see polio is because we have had historically such good coverage of polio vaccination? And so we do need to continue to make that case. But that's one of the challenges, because public health has saved everyone in Monroe County's life at some point in one way or another, and they don't know it. Whether that's, you know, we inspected a restaurant and kept you from getting food poisoning, or inspected a pool at a hotel and someone didn't get a waterborne illness. And so that's the challenge, is if we do our job well, you're not going to see a negative outcome.
You talked about whooping cough.
Mm-hmm.
We've occasionally seen pockets of measles.
Mm-hmm.
What are the kinds of things that you think are plausible developments that you don't want to see that could happen if we see a continuing move away from vaccination?
Well, we're certainly going to see more illness. We're going to see more kids get sick, more children spreading their germy selves and their cooties to some of our seniors and some of our elders or folks that have immunocompromising conditions. So we're going to see increases in hospitalizations and illness, in lost work days. We're going to see loss of life. I mean, many of these conditions were eradicated through vaccination or close to it, and we're going to see more sickness and more death, what we call morbidity and mortality.
Senator McConnell, thank you. Producer Megan Mack, quoting, and this comes from Gannett and USA Today, quote, the polio vaccine has saved millions of lives and held out the promise of eradicating a terrible disease. Right. Efforts to undermine public confidence in proven cures are not just uninformed, they're dangerous, McConnell said. He added, anyone seeking the Senate's consent to serve in the incoming administration would do well to steer clear of even the appearance of association with such efforts against things like the polio vaccine.
Right.
We'll see. It should be bipartisan. I think it's still, I think polio vaccines are still bipartisan for the moment.
I would hope.
We'll see. We're in a weird time. We don't know.
Yeah.
But let me also ask you a little bit about when you analyze how public health has performed.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about Pew Research and the indication that public trust in public health and medicine is at a low point, a generations-long low point. And you talk about misinformation campaigns, disinformation campaigns, and some of the nefarious actors. Is there anything that you think public health should have done differently that you think was sort of an own goal here that has contributed to some of this erosion of public trust?
Certainly, the pandemic taught us that we can do a lot of things better, a lot of things faster. There were certain, you know, limitations in terms of just the changing guidance from the CDC down through the State Department of Health, and some, you know, requirements that we just had to enact whether we were in favor of them or not. But certainly we could have been better prepared to get information out quicker. We could have been faster on the draw to make sure that we were translating information into the major languages that are so prevalent in our community. It took us embarrassingly long to get, you know, ASL speaking, signing, contact tracers. So some of those things we have learned. And also, I think the pandemic really shone a light on we need to do a much better job of addressing the mental health and well-being, the mental consequences of these kinds of pandemics. And when we think about the opioid epidemic, there needs to be a much more focus on helping people be mentally well, address past traumas so that they'll have more reserve, more resilience to be able to tolerate and respond in the healthiest way when things like a COVID pandemic hit or really any other, you know, life difficulty. So some of those areas of focus have really been brought to light, and we can definitely do a better job the next time we see another pandemic.
What do you make of critics who say that we, quote unquote, locked down too long or we didn't consider unintended consequences of that? What do you think?
I think we were doing the best we could in an unprecedented time. And again, some of those choices were not really left up to us at the local level. The public health focusing on the good for the biggest number of folks. And so keeping grandparents and seniors alive, addressing the disparities in terms of people of color contracting, being hospitalized, dying of COVID more at a disproportionate rate, focusing on reducing those negative outcomes for the good of focusing on those things and benefiting those populations actually benefits the entire community. And so sometimes, yes, there were business implications, and I don't minimize or act like those didn't occur. But from where I'm sitting, the preserving life and keeping people healthy did require many of those actions to be taken.
And I am curious to know what it was like sort of being on the inside. We're talking to the Monroe County Public Health Commissioner, Dr. Maria Elena Velez de Brown, who has been serving in the public health department here since 2016.
16, yep.
As deputy and now starting a six-year term as the public health commissioner. So the pandemic hits, and I think the thing that is really unhelpful now as we do try to learn honest lessons during what was a chaotic crisis, kind of fumbling, we're all fumbling around the dark. Journalists are, and the public is, and teachers are, and public health is. But people sometimes talk about it as if every county, every city, every state did the same thing, and that it was all locked down all the time. And what people tend to forget is the Bellow administration, the way I would characterize it is we had some listeners who would email me and say, you got to tell Adam Bellow, we have to have mask mandates everywhere. And this county didn't go as far as some.
Mm-hmm.
I know there was internal debate, and I know there was pressure on some to do more in terms of the mandate side. The county executive talked about the challenge of trying to get it right while having incomplete information. Your predecessor did on this program. Mm-hmm. So can you just describe for listeners what it was like as an administration kind of had those discussions and what it is like now when the critics mm-hmm. kind of act like, well, everybody everywhere just locked down all the time and nobody was allowed out of their house when there was an armed guard outside every house or something.
Right. And, those same traits and arguments that you raise with the COVID pandemic could be applied to the current struggles against the opioid epidemic. Mm. So if you don't mind, I'm gonna answer from that perspective.
Sure. Yeah.
Where, we are still, unfortunately, fighting against a lot of stigma around mental health disorders in general and substance use disorders specifically. And so we, too, receive comments about that are really just uninformed about the science of how addictive substances physically change your brain cells so that they are demanding this substance or you go through withdrawal. There's the changes in the brain, changes in the body, all kinds of things that compel a person to engage in behaviors that they wouldn't do if they weren't suffering from a substance use disorder. And so there's groups that don't understand the physiology, the biology of addiction. And so they don't understand why and are in disagreement with our department funneling, our opioid settlement dollars towards things like having naloxone, making that available to everyone, having our team go out and do outreach with folks that we know are actively using and offering them, are you ready to go to treatment? Funneling funds into a public media campaign that we recently launched that I hope folks have seen regarding highlighting some of our businesses that are trying to be a good neighbor in their area where we have identified overdoses happening. And so putting a Nalox box in their business, in the library, on the outer wall of whatever building that will allow us so that we can make these life-saving treatments available to the community at large at no cost, trying to get rid of the barriers of transportation, of insurance, all these things that we call the social drivers of health. There are lots of barriers to people getting treatment for their substance use disorder. And so a lot of our efforts are trying to keep people alive and give them that next chance to access treatment, to get their a peer support or get medication assisted therapy so that they can recover and build their lives back up and return to being a productive member of this community and this society. But we do hear those detractors who don't understand still have very negative views of it and feel like it's a waste of money. But again, those are loved ones, parents, cousins, spouses, people who had productive lives that we want to bring back into that state of health.
When I was a little kid, one of my first favorite baseball players was Daryl Strawberry, who went from the New York Mets to the Los Angeles Dodgers. And then a lot of his career hit a wall because of addiction. Mm. And one of his teammates on the New York Mets missed the World Series parade because he was with his cocaine dealer. Mm. And told that story in a documentary a few years ago on ESPN. But the manager of the Dodgers, Tony Lasorda, did a national interview talking about Daryl Strawberry in which he said, he doesn't have a sickness. He has a weakness about addiction.
Nope.
And it seems that 40 years almost later, that there's still some of that view.
That sentiment still exists.
How common do you think that sentiment is? And how, I know you feel very differently. How successful do you think you and your colleagues have been in changing that mindset?
I do think the mindset has changed somewhat. Certainly, in responding to this wave of addiction, the response has been much more medical, much more focused on treatment, getting Narcan, naloxone out in the community, getting folks connected to Suboxone, buprenorphine, lots of treatments. This is in stark contrast to the societal U.S. response to the crack cocaine epidemic, which needs to be said, impacted communities of color much more significantly, and that response was much more punitive, air quotes here, war on drugs. So I think there has been a shift in at least the policy responses, which I appreciate. And again, my team is out educating about Narcan everywhere they can. So we are making inroads. And again, I feel like there's a lot more people that are being educated and having their views changed than the very vocal minority that sometimes is much quicker to type whatever they want behind their screen.
Listeners, if you've got questions or comments, we can take your phone calls at 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. It's connections@WXXI.org. Dr. Maria Elena Velez de Brown is the Monroe County Public Health Commissioner. Our first conversation one-on-one with Dr. Velez de Brown since taking on the role of full-time, permanent public health commissioner, just a six-year term. It's a lot of work ahead. Yeah. And what does it say that, I saw in a separate interview you did where you acknowledged that, especially during the pandemic, there were threats to public health. Your predecessor had threats. He's talked about that. You've talked about, you know, some of the climate. Now, happily, you've said some of the really vitriolic and trolly stuff that we saw didn't drown out a productive conversation or the difficult conversations that had to happen, but it still gives you pause enough to where it was like a conversation. Like, if I'm going to take this job and things get weird again or rough again, will I have security, protection? Mm-hmm. What does it say that you need to have that conversation?
I mean, it's a sorry commentary on the state of our society that some individuals feel liberated to make threats that are sufficient to give folks like me pause when we come to considering an opportunity like this. I will say I am very grateful to the county administration. I took those concerns to them when we were first talking about my taking this position, and they took a number of steps right away to help ensure that myself and my family will be safe if something like that were to happen again. So I'm grateful to have that support from county administration. And it also helped that I've been in this department for 8 years. I know the staff. I have a great team that through all the pandemic, when we pulled them from doing their inspections or doing their nurse home visits, they came on board and worked tirelessly to try to protect and support their neighbors and our colleagues around the county. And so when I have a staff that's that dedicated, it makes it worthwhile. It makes it easier to decide to, yes, continue in this work. And ultimately, my faith, my personal worldview of really, you know, the Lord's going to protect my family, and I'm going to walk forward in faith in that because I have work to do that I've been called to do, and I'm just going to focus on that. I can't keep thinking about all the what ifs or the fear mongering that so many parties want us to engage in. A distraction.
Did anybody tell you not to take it?
Not to my face. I'm sure some folks have had those thoughts. But I think for such a time as this, I've been preparing. It was the natural next step in my career, and I'm grateful to have connections in this community and now be able to kind of elevate some voices and perspectives that maybe haven't had the attention that they deserve.
How big is the staff in the department?
We are 270-ish, 280.
And you feel like you've gotten to know a lot of the people already through the work that you've been doing already for 8 years.
Well, spending 12, 14, 18-hour days during the pandemic, you get to know folks pretty well. But yeah, no, the team is really fantastic. I'm really grateful for the staff that I have.
There's also the kinds of problems in the community that maybe some listeners aren't thinking about. And we're going to talk coming up here about literally problems like syphilis that Dr. Velez de Brown in different interviews have said, like, you might assume that we don't have those issues anymore. We do.
It's
we have
here.
Issues with gonorrhea, chlamydia. There's a sexual health clinic. We'll talk about some of that work coming up. Let me grab a phone call from Dennis in Rochester. Hello, Dennis. Go ahead.
Hey, Evan. I was calling because I wanted to harken back to the conversation about RFK Jr. And while I don't agree with many of his positions, I do think that he might be useful to put a spotlight on kind of the revolving door between the FDA and pharmaceutical companies and at least increase some scrutiny, because I do think there is a lot of corruption and manipulation between those two. And I'll listen to comments off air.
All right, Dennis, thanks for the phone call. Go ahead, Dr. Velez de Brown.
All of my experience has been at the local level, fortunately, I love this area. So I don't have too much to say about those two entities that the caller referenced. I had my reservations about the COVID vaccines and wondering about how quickly they came to market and were any steps skipped or missed. And I had the benefit of being able to sit in on some of the CDC webinars about how the vaccines went through all of the different steps in a regular clinical trials, and that some of the steps were just, instead of waiting for one to finish completely, do the analysis, move to the phase two, and then analysis phase three, that some of those were staggered as the data started to show positive outcomes so that we could get to the point of having a life-saving tool and get it out quickly, given the scope and scale of the COVID pandemic. So I got to see that reassurance and hear that reassurance from the scientists and the individuals who helped manage some of those clinical trials. And so that, again, is where I go back to trying to bring that information and educate and share with the community so that if it addressed my concerns about the vaccines, and I've gotten every single vaccine and every booster that I could, then we can translate that information into empowering action for community members.
I think his bigger concern is that doctors on every level are just, I don't think he's saying that you're personally corrupt. He thinks that the influence of pharma and, you know, sort of big money affects how doctors work, what they recommend, what they prescribe, and that behemoth is a problem.
Yeah, and that influence, I mean, he's not wrong that those factors and forces can influence practice, but that is one reason why many medical societies have taken a stand against allowing, you know, free samples in clinics and things like that, because we really want to bring the focus back on evidence-based practice. And so I'm grateful that now there are, you know, policies against the allowing pharmaceutical reps in many cases. In some cases, if you're, you know, putting in a new knee and you need the rep there to tell you how to use the new equipment or whatnot, sure, that's necessary. But the decision to use those tools generally has gone through a process that looks at the evidence and not just the influence of a pharmaceutical company or representative.
A few weeks ago on this program, we had a panel of doctors, and a listener asked if doctors get bonuses for recommending vaccines or having vaccine quotas. Do you want to address that?
No, I wish. We got a whole immunization clinic. That would help with our funding significantly, but no.
Not happening. Not part of the...
Nope.
Okay. So that, I mean, that misperception is, there's a lot of misperception out there.
And it's important, and it's good for me to hear these and learn about it. So then that can inform some of our educational campaigns and how do we approach different communities knowing what some of their concerns are. And that's part of just being a responsive clinician and a responsive agency.
What about the idea of a healthier society? And there's a lot of talk these days about ultra-processed food. Mm-hmm. You know, The Daily just did a whole podcast on that. That's kind of all the rage. And then New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg took a lot of heat when he wanted to put a cap on how big your big gulps could be. You know, like people are like, oh, nanny state. He wants to take away your soda. Terrible. And now RFK wants to take away half the cereal aisle. And the people who are like hammering Bloomberg are like, yes, take away those Cap'n Crunch.
Yep. Such an interesting pivot.
I do wonder how you feel about that debate. Is there a role for public health there? Are you comfortable with the foods we're generally eating or not eating? Because a lot of the ultra processed foods are also cheap, and people who are really struggling with poverty, I mean, it's easy to sort of lecture people on choices when you're not struggling. I know you care deeply about making sure access to WIC and SNAP and everything
healthy
is
food.
You know, so how do you square all that up?
Yeah, so this is a great opportunity to again revisit the idea that people don't make health choices in a vacuum. You mentioned food, and food insecurity is a huge problem. And so there are many people in our community across the country who are working 2 and 3 jobs and not making enough money to feed their families at the end of the month. So yes, that's why we need policy level solutions like WIC, like SNAP, that can literally give people funds to buy food. And I will take every opportunity to blow up myths. There's no welfare queen, air quotes here, buying lobster or filet mignon with their WIC or their SNAP checks, right? These are very prescriptive programs that are also educational in that they teach you, you can buy milk, you may not buy soda, that's the healthier option. And so those kinds of policy changes are very powerful. When we think about our food ecosystem, there are many policies on the books from the Depression era that are still subsidizing things like corn. And from there, you get high fructose corn syrup, which is a sweetener that does appear in lots of foods. I mean, even breads. You travel to Europe, the bread is not as sweet there as it is here because they don't add these sweeteners. And so if we change some of those policies and start to instead incentivize growing apples and whatever we have locally, how much of an impact could that have if we could decrease the price of the healthier, more nutrient-dense foods and level the playing field against some of these highly processed foods that are, you know, a lot of potentially empty calories and not as many nutrients? Although I will say, you know, when you think about, I don't even want to mention this, but, you know, think about the breastfeeding, chest feeding, bottle feeding debate. Fed is best. And so someone who lives in a food desert where there's no healthy food options for, you know, 5-10 miles, someone who lives in a food swamp, if your listeners haven't heard that term, that's where you got a corner store that will sell you sugar sweetened beverages, salty, sugary snacks, but doesn't carry any apples. Folks are going to make the best choice that they can. And if you throw in a transportation limitation where you don't have your own vehicle, you can take 2 buses to get to a grocery store. And then how much food can you carry back versus also the problem of working multiple jobs and not having time to get to the grocery store to prepare healthier foods. So there's a lot of judgment being passed, but the real opportunities should be policy level changes that make it easier to make the healthy choice, make the healthy choice the default choice, as opposed to having so many options of, you know, different ways to basically develop your diabetes earlier.
Well, speaking of policy change, you have said that we really don't have health care in this country. We have sick care.
Correct.
Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, unfortunately, many of the incentives in terms of how our healthcare system is financed pays for interventions. So you get sick, you come to my office, I bill for my time, I bill for, you know, a knee injection, I can pay for a surgery or, you know, some other treatment to address the illness after it has already happened, as opposed to having everyone universally have access to a dietitian who can help help you learn how to nourish your family in a healthier way. We don't have a lot of incentives in terms of getting minority communities through into some of those healthcare positions so that we can have culturally specific, culturally tailored services so that your dietitian is not going to recommend something for you to feed your family with foods you've never even heard of and doesn't take into account your cultural background. I'm grateful that there have been a number of different attempts to move more towards value-based payments, some changes in, you know, Medicaid and Medicare spending initiatives to try to be able to funnel some of those insurance funds towards community-based organizations that are going to then help overcome some of those barriers, connect folks to WIC or SNAP, or help them get transportation to their primary care doctors so that you can prevent the illness as opposed to just paying, you know, for medical transportation to the specialist to now address their heart disease or whatever. We definitely need to change the focus and put much more emphasis on teaching people how to live healthy and maintain their health as opposed to reacting and now trying to mitigate the consequences of illness.
Anne, I'll take your call in just a second. Anne from Penfield, stay there for a second, but let me just follow up with this point. In the current healthcare system that we have, can we achieve what you just talked about, or does it require systemic change?
I think there are many systemic changes that need to occur in order for my wildly improbable goals to be achieved.
Starting with,
oh goodness, where to start? Start at birth. Give me much more money for my nurse family partnership program so that we can empower pregnant women and their families and supporters to set a child on a healthy trajectory so we can have a credible source to walk with a woman and help her achieve the healthy goals she has for her pregnancy in the first 2 years of her life, and then set people up on a healthy trajectory. And then how do we get some of those funds so that we can have more community gardens and get more green space to address mental health and physical activity? There's so many things I would love to change.
All right, let me grab Anne in Penfield next on the phone. Hey, Anne, go ahead.
Oh, hi. Boy, doctor, I'm really impressed with your experience and with your vitality and with your energy. It's refreshing and just delightful. I'm a member of a group locally that's called the Elder Justice Committee from Metro Justice, and I think we probably share a lot of the same kinds of goals and aspirations. We have people at various meetings that come and talk to us about problems that they're having with parents or loved ones who are in nursing homes. And even though there have been some legislative efforts to get more staffing, that's not the only consequence of having the limitations on nursing staff in the nursing homes. It turns out that a lot of people are being given Haldol at night and morphine in the daytime. They may be also on warfarin as a blood thinner or quetiapine. They're being given antidepressants and antipsychotics. And all of these things, especially in elderly people, I'm telling you things you are obviously trained in already, but it's a case where we have populations throughout Monroe County and Western New York of people that are elderly that may be too doped up to be able to advocate for themselves. And their parents or loved ones have been trying to reach people from the New York State Department of Health. And they're being told, well, we might be able to get back to you in a few more weeks, probably more like a few more months. And I'm wondering if there's something that you could recommend that we could help to spur this attention, because you certainly have the zeal and the ambition, and I'm just wondering what kind of programs that you might suggest, you know, for this situation.
Thank you for the question. So unfortunately, our department does not regulate the nursing home facilities. So I don't have any kind of statutory authority to kind of go in there and make changes. Certainly, individuals should have some sort of an ombudsman or an entity that they can take these concerns to. And I hear you on the concern about turning to New York State and getting a response of that's going to take too long to satisfy one. You know, the nursing home situation, the caller mentions a staffing crisis, and that is true. We don't fund, we don't compensate many members of the caring professions. So these like home health aides and nursing home staff, for that, we don't fund teachers and compensate them the way we should. And so again, there's a lot of these incentives that don't meet our societal goals of wanting every population, whether they're in a nursing home or whether they're children or anyone else, to meet their maximal health potential. I'm afraid I'm not going to satisfy your caller because I don't have any different answers other than whatever the system is that the patient is living in. There is a patient advocacy. There has to be a patient advocacy avenue to take those concerns to, and just keep banging on the doors at New York State, because the more concerns and complaints those specific offices receive, the higher those issues are prioritized for a response.
I mean, there's a lot of sentiment reflected like Ann's. A lot of people are so impressed with the county health commissioner, public health commissioner, who's been with us for the hour. You're getting a lot of love from listeners who are very happy to hear. So I hope this will be the first of many conversations. I will say the host is getting a little less love. I'll read an email from someone who's not happy with me, which is fine. Dallas says, Evan, you're mixing apples and oranges. It's not that RFK wants to take away half the cereal aisle. He wants BHT out of it. If Canada and Europe doesn't let it in their cereal or the same brand sold here, why would you be factually incorrect and say he wants to take the cereal aisle away? So to be clear, he also wants tartrazine out. I don't know if that's the same thing as BHT. Maybe that is. That's not my expertise. And I don't know at all what those compounds do or don't do. I was not maligning RFK, Dallas. He does right now want to wipe out about half the cereal aisle as it exists. He's not saying he wants cereal not to exist. What I am skeptical of are the people who bashed Michelle Obama and Michael Bloomberg when they talked about either healthier school lunches, more nutrition for communities that have historically not had access to it, as Michelle Obama worked on as the first lady, or when Michael Bloomberg was mayor and wanted to, you know, limit the size of the big gulps, and people mocked him. And now the same people are like, yeah, get those cereals. Then I feel like there's something inconsistent. When people hammer vaccines and they say vaccines are not to be trusted, and yet their avatar in politics, Donald Trump, now doesn't even feel like he can talk about the vaccines that Operation Warp Speed produced, which most people in public health think was a triumph. The vaccines that came through, very well vetted in a short amount of time during COVID. Donald Trump told Leslie Stahl during this last campaign he didn't even feel like he could talk about it because his own voters don't like him anymore, don't like the vaccines anymore. So I'm just asking people to be consistent. There will be a debate about additives in food. That'll probably be a good debate. That's probably what we should. You heard Dr. Velez de Brown talk about high fructose corn syrup. It's not great. It's a question of policy, what you do about it. There's a lot of power in Iowa and the Midwest. We'll see how those states feel about it. But maybe the next administration will go after it policy-wise. And I've never heard anybody in public health say, well, if Trump does it, I don't like it. But if Biden does it, I like it. I hear people in public health say, we're going to evaluate it policy by policy. And if it's good for people, we will support it. I think that's what I'm hearing from you, Dr. Velez de Brown.
Yes. I mean, it doesn't matter which individual is in any specific position of power. Our goal is to help the entire community be healthy. Our goal is to help inform people. And it doesn't even have to be about controversial things like food additives. Like, just remind folks right now, it is not too late to get your flu shot, your COVID shot, your RSV shot. If you are sick, some of our education is very basic. It is not sexy. If you're sick, please stay home and keep your germs to yourself. If you're an employer, please pay your staff, offer them paid sick leave so they won't come and spread whatever illness we're talking about. Let's all remember how to wash our hands, which some of us had to relearn during the pandemic. But, you know, some of these very basic things don't have to be controversial, but they can contribute to your own health and the health of the people around you.
People are surprised to hear syphilis is still around. And it is.
It is.
I mean, gonorrhea, chlamydia, syphilis. Yeah. Tell me about the state of those issues in the community and what's being done.
Yeah, so the concern specifically around syphilis, often in my training, in my head, I categorize that as a condition that mostly occurred in the population of men who have sex with men. And then with the liberalization of kind of sexual practices, it started to cross into more women contracting syphilis. And it's bad for everyone to get syphilis, but specifically in women of childbearing age, then we run into the problem of congenital syphilis, which can lead to stillbirth, it can lead to congenital malformations, it can lead to deafness, you know, all these consequences for a child who had nothing to do with, if you want to talk about choices, the choices of the adults in their lives. And so there were increases in national rates of congenital syphilis. We went years where we had zero cases, and then we had a, you know, I don't know, 500% increase with, you know, 16 cases in 1 year. It doesn't sound like a lot, but going from nothing to so many of those cases, I mean, the State Department of Health really came to us and was like, what is happening and what are we going to do about it? So what we have been doing about it is I personally was able to serve on a committee through New York State that was working on how do we kind of eliminate this, working with our partners in our sexual health clinic, Dr. Margie Urban, educating our OBGYN colleagues in both health systems about, hey, let's remind ourselves, what does primary, secondary, tertiary syphilis look like? How often should you test? We talked about policy changes. So now there's a policy that one should test for syphilis in every trimester, not just the first or the second, because we were finding cases where someone was negative, negative, and then they get reinfected and the child still has a negative outcome. So all of that work has been going towards lowering the rates of babies being born with some of the consequences of congenital syphilis, but also just the basic work that my sexual health clinic has been doing and our STI control team has been doing for decades, which is go out, offer free testing, free confidential testing, connect people to treatment, connect people with HIV to treatment to get them on antiretroviral medications to lower their viral load so that if they do engage in unprotected sexual activity, they're much less likely to spread that virus as well. And so some of the bread and butter public health of educating, offer condoms, offer people confidential testing where they are. So going out into communities, homeless shelters or food pantries or soup kitchens, wherever people are, being willing to work with populations that sometimes get ignored. A population like sex workers in different areas of the county that don't have a lot of power to negotiate condom use. Let's get them tested. Let's get them treated. Let's get them connected to the resources they need if they are pregnant and have tested positive.
Down to our last minute, we've talked about a lot of different issues that you've already been working on, that you will be working on. What stands out as the hardest to solve that you think over these next 6 years?
The hard things to solve are going to be the bigger, as I mentioned, social drivers or social determinants of health. We need to talk and address racism as a public health threat, not just historical racism and its kind of current day consequences, but current systemic racism that refers to just kind of preferences that are baked into the institutions that we all interact with every day. We've got to address poverty. So some of that racism that led to housing discrimination has now concentrated specific populations in specific areas. And so how do we level the playing field? How do we address disparities in education so that individuals can go out and get that good job that's going to give them the insurance, that's going to give them the upward mobility, be able to invest in owning a home and passing on generational wealth. So my intention is to get myself and some of my staff out sitting at more of these tables to address these big thorny problems, because that's where we're really going to make advances in health for all of the community.
I hope that we'll see you with some routine here. I really I appreciate
like
this. David sends a note saying, cheers for the new health commissioner. Thank you for a great hour.
Thank you.
I'll echo that. Thank you very much. And I look forward to the future conversations we'll have here.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Dr. Maria Elena Velez de Brown, Monroe County Public Health Commissioner. We've got more connections coming up in a moment.